Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to have General Nicholson to brief you today. He needs no introduction from me, but he will start with his introduction and then he'll be happy to take your questions.
Thanks very much, Juana. Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be with you again and give you an update on the situation in Afghanistan. Before I begin, I want to recognize the contributions of soon-to-be 41 troop-contributing nations in Afghanistan. It's an honor to command such a committed force. More importantly, I want to recognize the strength of the Afghan people and of that of the Afghan security forces. Their service and sacrifice, along with a resolute international commitment led by NATO and the U.S.'s South Asia strategy, have led to where we are today. And as I'm sure you're all aware by now, the President of Afghanistan has made another bold step towards peace and stability in Afghanistan with his ceasefire announcement. This announcement was widely endorsed, including by NATO, the European Union, the United Nations, the U.S. Department of State, and others. We know that the Taliban is still considering this, but we also continue to see additional endorsements from around the world roll in. I therefore want to put all this in context and explain what it means moving forward. The combination of the Warsaw Summit in 2016, followed by President Ghani's security roadmap, and President Trump's South Asia policy have all led to progress in Afghanistan. As President Ghani says, the U.S. South Asia policy has been a game changer. The objective of this strategy is reconciliation, and the strategy is working. Within 6 months of President Trump's announcement of the South Asia policy, we had the elements of a peace offer outlined by the Taliban in an open letter to the American people. 2 weeks later, there was a formal peace offer by His Excellency President of Afghanistan to the Taliban. His proposal was unanimously endorsed by the international community at the Kabul Peace Process Conference and again at the Tashkent Conference. At the same time, interestingly, we saw levels of violence begin to drop. Between February, when the peace offers were made, and April, when the Taliban announced their offensive, levels of enemy-initiated violence were 30% below the five-year average. And in the month or so since the Taliban announced their offensive at the end of April, violence has increased, but it is still below the five-year average. That means to me that we are in a period of fighting and talking. And as Secretary Mattis said to you not too long ago, violence and progress can coexist. We have seen this in other conflicts, such as in Colombia, or even Northern Ireland. We are seeing it in Afghanistan. Now, let me put the violence in context. This year, for the first time, the Afghan security forces conducted continuous offensive operations in all six core areas throughout the winter. When the Taliban began their attacks on district centers, the ANDSF successfully repelled 80% of these attacks. And the attacks that were successful, about 20% of the time, five district centers were taken during this period. All five were recaptured by the Afghan security forces within hours or days. The one exception to attacks on remote district centers was the one on the city of Farah, provincial capital in southwest Afghanistan. Within 18 hours of the beginning of this attack, 500 Afghan commandos and special police were on their way to Farah, and they were doing it by Afghan means. So this included the Afghan Air Force moving them and their own wheeled vehicles. Within 24 hours after the attack, these forces were on the ground in Farah and drove the Taliban out of the city and then pursued them into the surrounding districts for the next week. During this pursuit, many of the Taliban leaders and fighters returned to their bases in Helmand. We followed them back there and struck their leadership meetings in Helmand, killing dozens of their leaders. So the end result of that whole episode was that Farah is under control of the Afghan government within 24 to 36 hours. The enemy leaders who conducted the attack, many were killed, and the networks that did it were severely disrupted. So another example of the increased performance of the Afghan security forces occurred on the 30th of May. 10 terrorists attempted to penetrate the Ministry of Interior building in Kabul. They were identified and stopped at the gate that they attempted to get in. All but one were killed in a firefight with Afghan security forces led by Crisis Response Unit 222, and they never gained entry to their objective. Again, another enemy failure. Now, these successes by the Afghan security forces are just a few examples of the improvements we've seen in the Afghan security fighting abilities. And, of course, this is the focus of our international effort in Afghanistan. So the NATO-led Train, Advise, and Assist mission, much like the U.S. South Asia strategy, is working in Afghanistan. The Taliban are no longer attempting to gain new ground. Rather, they are trying to inflict casualties and gain media attention. They are fighting in order to strengthen their bargaining position. Now, as many of you all know, on the 4th of June, up to 3,000 of Afghans' most senior religious scholars held a meeting in Kabul, Aloya Jirga, and issued a religious decree, or fatwa. In it, they refuted the religious justification used by the Taliban for their war in Afghanistan. They specifically rejected the religious justification for suicide attacks and terrorist attacks. They called on all the parties in the war, the government and the Taliban, to come to peace. And they also requested a ceasefire up through Eid al-Fitr. That evening, President Ghani accepted the fatwa and the clerics' call for a ceasefire, and yesterday he announced the ceasefire. The ceasefire applies to the Taliban. Afghan and U.S. forces will intensify their efforts against ISIS-K, al-Qaeda, and other international terrorist networks. Before I finish here, I want to shift to one other topic. So we in the international community want to applaud the important efforts of the many brave Afghan citizens who are advocating for peace. These peace activists include young people, women, and civil society leaders across the country. These efforts are not aligned with the Taliban, they're not aligned with the government, and they're not aligned with the coalition. They call on all of us equally in the cause of peace. And to these peace advocates, I say, we deeply respect your courage. Our willingness to participate in the ceasefire is strengthened because of your example, because you are showing the world that the noble Afghan people truly want peace. Thank you, and I'll take your questions.
Okay. We'll go to One TV, second row.
Thank you very much, General. My question is regarding the security realities at the moment in Afghanistan and the uncertainty toward the political solution for Afghanistan. We have seen the most generous offer from side of President Ghani recently to the Taliban, but the Taliban continuously rejected the peace offers of the Afghan government. On the other hand, reality shows that militarily it has been tough to defeat the Taliban in the last 15 years. What's going to be the best solution for the current dilemma in your perspective?
Thank you for the question. I think the U.S. South Asia policy announced by President Trump is actually important to consider for many of the key points. It addresses some of the issues that you raised. So the U.S. South Asia policy that he announced in August specifically addresses this issue of external enablement. So no insurgency that enjoys external enablement can be defeated easily. And of course, the Taliban have enjoyed external sanctuaries and support for many, many years. I think, frankly, one of the other issues is that we in the international community stated that we were leaving. And so when the enemy knew that we had planned on departing, that we were winding up our mission, as we said we were, then there was no incentive to engage in the peace process. So all this changed about 9 or 10 months ago when the U.S. South Asia policy was announced by the president, and this came on the heels of the Warsaw summit. So I think this has changed the context for the conversation about peace. So we've gone from a position where we in the international community said that we were departing, and this emboldened the enemy to believe that all they had to do was wait us out. Unfortunately, it also may have encouraged hedging behaviors by some of the neighbors, who we know have then increasingly supported the Taliban. But now, with President Trump's announcement of the South Asia policy, we have said we're on a conditions-based mission. And indeed, NATO has said this as well at the Warsaw summit. So we've said we're here on a conditions basis, not a time basis. We're directly addressing external enablement. And the purpose of the entire policy is a peaceful reconciliation to the conflict. And I would reiterate that this is in everyone's interest. Even the neighbors and those who enable the Taliban have an interest in counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, and stability in Afghanistan. Stability in Afghanistan will prevent the spread of terrorism. It will reduce migrancy into Europe. It is in everyone's benefit. So I would say that what we're doing in the coalition and in the United States with respect to the South Asia policy is indeed in the interest of everyone in the region. And things have changed now just 10 months ago, as I explained, with respect to this dialogue about peace. Thank you.
Mitra TV in the first row.
Mr. General, I have two questions. The first one is about, you know, there is a perception in Afghanistan that normally the international troops who are in Afghanistan, they are stressing more on defensive capabilities on the Afghan troops. For example, the perception is that the Afghan forces, the Afghan security forces, the police, they are only there to protect the people, not to attack the Taliban. So don't you think more needs to be done, actually, to attack them rather than defend the people? And then the second question is, you know, regarding the U.S. South Asia strategy. How far do you think we have come, bearing in mind that people see more bloodshed, you know, war, and, of course, the Taliban getting more aggressive in Afghanistan?
Yeah, let me answer the second one first. I think it's, given that President Trump announced the South Asia policy on the 21st of August, 2017, within 6 months, we had an open letter by the Taliban to the American people, which outlined some of the principles of a negotiated conclusion of the war. And 2 weeks later, you had a peace offer by President Ghani. I don't think that these would have occurred, especially the letter from the Taliban, had it not been for the change in the South Asia policy on top of the NATO Warsaw Declaration, where 39 nations in the coalition committed to 4 more years of support to Afghanistan. So these sent very strong signals to the enemy and to those who support them that they could not wait us out, that instead of our previous policy of leaving based on a timeline, we were going to leave based on conditions. Moving to your first point, after the Warsaw Summit in 2016, President Ghani looked at consulting with his security ministers and examined what the Afghan security forces needed to be able to do going forward. And in fact, the purpose of this was to drive the enemy to reconciliation. In order to do that, the army and the security forces needed more offensive capability. So at this time, he made the decision to double the size of the special forces. And these, as you know, are the forces that take the offensive against the enemy. In 2016, this number of companies that we had was about 30. But by next year, there will be over 60 TOLEs, 60 companies of commandos. There will also be a significant increase in the size of the Air Force. Now, last year, in 2017, the Afghan Air Force really began to come into its own. And we saw that between the attack helicopters and the A-29s, about half of the strikes being done in the country, airstrikes, were being done by the Afghan Air Force. This year in 2018, we've seen the Air Force begin to drop laser-guided bombs. This year in 2018, we've seen the first Black Hawk pilots, Afghan Black Hawk pilots, trained and flying combat missions. So we're beginning to see the effects of the decisions that President Ghani made in 2016 begin to result in new capabilities in the field. Now, this year, the security forces will be very focused on election security. So this is a principal focus of what they're doing. But as we go into next year, and additional commandos take the field, remembering 4,000 new commandos are on the battlefield this year, and that number will double again next year, so there'll be another 5,000 next year on the field, and more aircraft. So the offensive capability that you're talking about to take the fight to the enemy is going to increase in the coming year, and that is what's going to enable the Afghan army to begin doing what you suggest.
Okay, we'll go to GOTV, gentleman in the blue shirt in the middle.
Khalid Hamid Farooqi from Geo Television News, Pakistan, and Jung Group of Newspaper. General, we understand who you are attributing that activity of sanctuary to neighbors in particular. General Bajwa visited Kabul recently, and it's still in your talk, seems there is some sort of difference on sanctuaries are going on. Kabul government offered Taliban peace deal, and they are rejecting. What is the role of Pakistan at the moment in that offer? Are you approaching Pakistan to help them to bring Taliban to the negotiating table?
Thank you for the question. And as you know, as part of the South Asia policy, this was one of the principal points, was to reduce external enablement. And I don't need to repeat the statements that President Trump has said, that our Vice President has said, Vice President Pence, and the Secretaries of State and Defense and all the U.S. leaders, because those statements are a matter of record. What we are very encouraged by is the improving bilateral relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So Prime Minister Abbasi has visited Afghanistan twice, and we know Chief of Army Staff Bajwa has also visited Afghanistan. We are encouraged by what they are saying, that they are committed to peace in Afghanistan, and we certainly wish to see that come to fruition. We believe that the Pakistan military and Pakistan are in a unique position to influence the Taliban in terms of their pursuit of the peace process. And we hope to see this translate into participation by the Taliban in the peace process. So the very generous offer by His Excellency President Ghani to the Taliban has yet to be satisfactorily answered in that respect. So we hope to see Taliban or the Pakistan play a positive role in that. And again, it is in Pakistan's interest as well as Afghanistan's interest for this war to be brought to a peaceful conclusion. The recent visit by Minister Atmar to Pakistan and the work that's being done on the Afghanistan-Pakistan agreement is extremely positive. And as you all know, this particular document addresses many issues of joint concern to both countries, to include refugee returns, border security, as well as peace and reconciliation, and importantly, economic issues. So if we can improve the trade and economic activity between the two countries, Afghanistan becomes a conduit for power and goods from Central Asia to make their way to Pakistan. All of these things are in the interest of Pakistan. The final thing I would say is that with the strong international commitment to Afghanistan, we don't believe that Afghanistan will be used as a launching point for attacks against Pakistan. And the international community is committed to helping in that regard. Thank you.
Okay. Salam Watanda, gentleman over there.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. This is Nasser Memaniki from Salam Watanda, and I have two questions. The first one is on peace and reconciliation. We know that this is not the first time that these efforts are being undertaken. When in one of the peace or in negotiation rounds, the discussion of bringing Taliban, bringing Mullah Omar or having Mullah Omar's approval came on the table. That's when Pakistan announced that Mullah Omar was dead for about 2 years. And so what confidence is there that there is a specific group, there are specific individuals that the Afghan government and possibly the international community is in discussions with on peace and reconciliation in Afghanistan? The second question is on, in recent attacks, we've seen that the Taliban have been able to capture a lot of heavy equipment from the Afghan forces, a number of Humvees, I don't know how many tanks. And do you have a specific number, and does Afghan government have a specific number of Humvees that the Taliban own now? And how concerning is it to the international community, to NATO, and to the Afghan government? Because we've seen that they've used some of the Humvees as weapons, packed them with explosives and blown up bases. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'll answer the second question first. So we are concerned about this. And frankly, this loss of equipment typically occurs at isolated checkpoints that are then overrun by the Taliban. So we've consulted closely with our Afghan Security Force colleagues to encourage them to reduce the number of checkpoints, to consolidate these positions, to make them stronger, and to be more offensive in their operations. And so this is something that we're working closely with our Afghan colleagues on. I know the challenge in many cases is that the communities inside Afghanistan want these checkpoints to protect the entrances to the communities and so forth. So there is a tension there between what is the best tactic militarily and what are the needs of the society. And so this is the tension that creates these situations where isolated checkpoints can be overrun by the Taliban, and that's where they're getting these vehicles and equipment, and when they overrun isolated checkpoints. So what we're seeing is, in many cases, is better cooperation. I'll use the example of Helmand, where General Ahmadzai, working closely with the police and the NDS down there, have created a much better system of interlocking checkpoints. They also have where police and army support one another, where we have pre-planned fires, at nighttime when the enemy likes to attack these checkpoints. We have pre-planned illumination and other ways that they can defend themselves better, and also better leadership and a better defensive posture at these checkpoints is really critical. So I think the checkpoint reduction and hardening the checkpoints is going to be one of the keys to preventing the capture of equipment. If you look at, on the other side of the scale, the commandos seldom, if ever, lose a battle, much less any of their equipment. And why is this? Because they're on the offensive, because they're highly trained, they're properly led, they have an offensive spirit, and they get after the enemy. So we are, as things like the inherent law are implemented and leaders are changed inside the Afghan army, and they're younger. And so with the changes in the inherent law this year, the average age of the generals and colonels in the Afghan army is going to go down by 10 years. Okay, now as you get younger, more energetic commanders in the field, we think we're going to see greater aggressiveness and offensive action on the part of the regular army formations. And what we'd like to see is this get to the same level as the commandos. So this is something the army's working on. And again, these reforms that are taking place that President Ghani has directed are the things that are going to enable this to happen. To your first question, I think, yes, there were attempts at negotiation in the past, but again, the international community said they were leaving. And so even when the Murray talks occurred that you referred to earlier, when it was revealed that Mullah Omar was deceased, the policy of the international community at that time was that we were going to be departing Afghanistan. And I think this one fact sent the strongest possible signal to the enemy that all they had to do was wait us out. And so I think that has fundamentally changed. So by saying we're here on a conditions basis, by saying that it's no longer a time-based withdrawal, and the universal international support for President Ghani's peace offer, which again, there had never been a peace offer of this type on the table before. I think these things are different than the past. What was encouraging about that initiative that you mentioned before was we were approaching a moment where Taliban and Afghan government representatives would sit down in the same room. And so this was encouraging. And so we hope to find a way to get back to that so we can move this process forward.
Okay, we'll go to NPR, Deutsche Welle.
Hello.
You seem to be quite critical of this decision to leave.
I didn't hear the first part.
Yeah, you seem to be quite critical of the decision to announce the pull out the deadline. I'm wondering if you have any other thoughts as you are going to be wrapping up your posting in Afghanistan. Had you hoped that the country would be in a better place than it will be when you leave? What did you envision when you came in?
Yeah, the NATO conditions-based approach was the best military advice of the NATO coalition. This advice began as early as 2015, and the idea was that when you're fighting a conflict, you don't tell the enemy when you're leaving. And if you tell that to the enemy, then they know all they have to do is survive until that moment. And so there's no incentive to engage in a reconciliation or a peace process. So from a military standpoint, in terms of military logic, that decision undermined the ability to advance the peace process. And what I'm pointing out is the difference now with President Trump's South Asia policy is that we have said we are on a conditions basis. At the Warsaw summit in 2016, the entire coalition said we were adopting a conditions-based approach. So as you've heard that phrase, war is an extension of politics. So the policy matters. The policy matters. And so the policy that says you're on a conditions-based, not a time-based approach fundamentally changes the calculus of the enemy when it comes to determining whether they even need to participate in a peace process or just stall for time. And so that decision was key to changing the calculus of the enemy. And I think that's why we've seen within 6 months of that decision, peace offers being discussed from both sides. And so that was a fundamental change and extremely important in terms of the conduct of the campaign. Thank you.
My second question, any other look back since it's been announced?
I'll wait for any retrospective until, when I'm ready to move on a few months from now.
So
thank you very much. We'll have a chance to chat later. Thanks.
Okay, we'll go to the lady in the front row.
Ala Shari from Ruda Media Network from Iraq. My question is about Syria. According to the roadmap between USA and Turkey, when will SDF withdraw from Manbij? This is important for me to know.
Ma'am, I'm not really the right guy to answer that question. I'm focused on Afghanistan.
Okay, thank you.
But I'll be glad to refer your question to U.S. Central Command.
Okay.
So that they can take that.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we go to 8 a.m. daily. Gentleman over here.
Thank you, General. My question is on. I saw that you also welcomed President Ghani's ceasefire. You are in Afghanistan. You know the realities of war in Afghanistan. This ceasefire is only with Taliban. How do you differentiate between a Taliban fighter or a Daesh fighter or a Qani network fighter? This is what's your comment on that?
So as you know, in the ceasefire, President Ghani has made the ceasefire with the Taliban, not with Daesh or al-Qaeda or other international terrorist organizations. And we have many ways that we differentiate them. Of course, if they were standing in the room here, it might be difficult to differentiate them. But if there are other ways that we can do that through various forms of intelligence. And so we have confidence that we can differentiate between the two. Some of this is as simple as geographical. We know that in certain areas you have a Taliban presence or you have an ISIS presence. For example, in southern Nangarhar right now is the largest concentration of Daesh fighters. We are intensifying our efforts against that element right now. So we have Operation Hamza 3 is underway that is being directed against Daesh fighters in southern Nangarhar. As we go into the ceasefire, we may be able to reallocate air assets from elsewhere in the country to focus on this target. So, in fact, there will be an intensification of the operations against Daesh. And interestingly, we have a common enemy in Daesh. So we, the Afghan forces and the Taliban, all share a common enemy in Daesh. And so if the ceasefire indeed progresses, then we will be able to intensify our operations during the ceasefire against Daesh. On the other hand, we will maintain our vigilance and self-defense of all of our coalition forces and bases, as well as the Afghans. And so we have the capacity to do this. And if Afghan forces are attacked, we will respond in self-defense of our Afghan comrades.
Kuwaiti News Agency, Kuna.
General, do you see any role for the Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, like Kuwait, like UAE to contribute in promoting the peace process in Afghanistan?
I'm sorry, role for who?
Role for the Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE in promoting the peace process in the country.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Absolutely. And so I'd say on a couple of levels. First is the ulama is crucial to moving forward. So again, in Afghanistan, what has precipitated this decision by President Ghani was the ulama of Afghanistan meeting and considering the religious justification for the war. And then their number one, they found that the justification was not in their view of these prominent religious scholars. They felt that the war was not justified from a religious perspective. But additionally, they also call for peace, as at the hardship that was being endured by the Afghan people. So when a group of religious scholars of this stature and respect calls for peace, this is an important message. And, of course, the broader ulama of the broader Islamic world is extremely important in this conversation. And so we saw recently the meetings in Indonesia, and so perhaps similar meetings could be held in other parts of the Islamic world. And of course, the OIC has a meeting in July. I believe it's around the same time as the NATO summit. But this is one of the questions that we believe could be considered by the OIC, is how this could be addressed. So these are questions for those nations and those ulamas to make. But I know that the Afghan government has approached those nations and asked them to help in a mediating way to get the conversation started between the Taliban and the government and to hopefully advance the peace process. So yes, they could play a very helpful role, and we hope they do.
Tolo?
General, you talked about the Afghan war as a stalemate last year in Congress. Is the stalemate broken?
Yeah, I think that what is new since I spoke to Congress last year is President Trump's South Asia policy. And so this South Asia policy was based on the recommendations of his whole national security team. And I believe, as you heard Secretary Mattis say in his remarks, that the fundamental logic of this policy has been proven. And again, I come back to the fact that the objective of the policy is to get to a reconciliation of the conflict, and that by bringing about a peaceful reconciliation, violence will go down, stability will increase, and that this will prevent a couple of things. One, international terrorists from finding sanctuary in Afghanistan from which they could conduct attacks, and it will help the Afghan people who have suffered so long for so many years to enjoy stability, and then this is good for the whole region. So this is the fundamental logic of the policy. So this logic then is what has fundamentally changed things and brought about the conversation about reconciliation. Now, with respect to the military aspects on the battlefield, the other thing that occurred, President Ghani's vision for the security forces, which is captured in his roadmap, and I mentioned it before about doubling the size of the special forces, doubling or even tripling the Air Force, professionalizing the force. These things don't happen overnight. This takes time. I mentioned some of those accomplishments before. 4,000 commandos added this year, another 5,000 next year. Black Hawk helicopters arrived in September. Afghan pilots are flying them in combat now. You have Afghan pilots dropping laser-guided bombs. I mean, these are things when we just had the first bomb drop off an A-29 2 years ago. So these are tremendous improvements that are occurring. And as I mentioned, with the new younger leadership coming into play, and with with great respect, the older generation of leaders are retiring, all of these things are going to make a difference. So what you're going to see is an increase in capability on the part of the Afghan security forces. I just talked about, in my opening statement, the success that the Afghan security forces have had in defending. So yes, there's violence, but the fact that there's violence or even the same level of violence, it's what's going on inside the violence. What I tried to explain is how the Afghan forces are better defending, their better performance on the battlefield, their defense against terrorist attacks. I'll give you another example. We have seen a decrease in vehicle-borne IEDs inside the city of Kabul. Now, any IED is horrible, and especially ones that are indiscriminate and kill civilians are horrendous. But since a year ago, when we had that horrible tragedy of the mega V-bid on the 31st of May, 2017, we have not had another truck bomb of that size come into the city. And this is in large measure due to the great work by the Afghan security forces in trying to stop truck bombs. Now, we still have person-borne IEDs, and we've seen those, and those are bad news. But we are seeing improvements, and I think it's important to get into the details of what's happening to really understand how these improvements are being made. So I see a positive trend in terms of the security forces. And that's what I base that on, some of those details.
Okay, one very last question. Yeah, lady over there.
My name is Anna Vandenska. I'm from Eurodiplomatic. General, I've noticed that Secretary Mattis addressed very exactly to physical caliphate. So he wasn't saying caliphate, but physical caliphate. So I presume there is a division between ideology and acting people. So if NATO is responsible to fighting and defeating physical caliphate, who you think is responsible to fight this lethal ideology?
Who's responsible to fight the ideology of the enemy? Yeah. That's a great question. So a couple comments on that. First off, much of the enemy activity, what we're calling enemy activity, is done to maintain instability so they can profit from the drug trade. So many of these fighters and leaders who might have started out with an ideological motivation are now motivated by money. And so when you look at the amount of heroin that's being produced in Afghanistan and shipped around the world, there are many who profit from that. And so just as we've seen insurgencies in Colombia, for example, morph from a ideologically motivated surgery to a money-making operation, there is a dimension of that going on in Afghanistan. And when you consider that 60% of the funding of the Taliban, at least, comes from the drug trafficking, you can see that the ideology is not as pure as it may once have been. Now, that's not to say there aren't others who are ideologically motivated. I believe there are. And so this ideological motivation, as we saw last Monday, needs to be addressed by the religious scholars whose religion is being used to promote this motivation. And so what you saw last Monday were the top close to 3,000 religious scholars of Afghanistan convene and consider the ideological basis for continuing the war. And what they offered was a religious opinion based upon their very learned opinions and their scholarship, which rejected the ideological basis for the war. And so it went point by point through the things I mentioned and many others, the war in general, suicide bombing, terrorist attacks. You know, is it proper to wage jihad against an Islamic Republic? Their answer was no. Who can declare jihad? I mean, it was a very thorough document. If you haven't had an opportunity to examine it, I encourage you to do so, because it addresses all of these points. And so this fatwa is complemented by a fatwa in Pakistan that was issued by the Pakistan ulama. And the Pakistan ulama considered many of the same questions. And then there was an ulama held in Indonesia recently in which religious scholars from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other countries met again to consider these questions. And I mentioned before the OIC meeting coming up in this summer. And so I think these are some of the most effective ways that the ideology can be addressed. And it's encouraging to me to see that it is being addressed and that these questions are not, you know, being addressed by the coalition. They're being addressed by the religious scholars inside the region. And this is very appropriate. This is exactly who needs to be addressing this.
Thank you very much. This concludes this press conference. Thank you, General.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for the media, we will soon have Defense Minister Bahrami. So please stay in place.
Thank you very much.